nonprofit boards and open board of long-term care companies.
And I'm pleased to introduce Richard Nicolazzo. Richard and I have known each other. I don't even remember when we first met. It was a long. Yeah. He is a managing partner of Nicolazzo and Associates. It's in the field of communications, management, merger and acquisition communication, issues management, litigation support, media relations, and crisis communications. Exactly the kind of guy that Governor Romney needs today. Richard has appeared on broadcast business shows such as CNN Money's Line. He's contributed articles and blogs to the Boston Globe, the Boston Business Journal. He's been a speaker at NASDAQ, American Executive Program, Investor Relations. He is has been on the board of directors of the North Shore Music Theater and the Boston Center of the Arts. He's been on the examining committee of the Boston Public Library, WGBH-TV's Business Task Force. He's the former director of the Newton Boys and Girls Club, and he currently serves on Boston University's College of Communications Board of Visitors. So, sit down here.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Larry. Well, there goes the name tag again. Are we live, Larry? Or?
We're live, yep.
Okay. Thank you for inviting me to come out and meet with this group tonight. It's always fun to sit with a group of people that, one, have an interest in hearing what you have to say. That's always very gratifying. And two, my objective here tonight is to try to understand what you would like to see coming out of this, the takeaway, if you will. You know, what made you come to hear what I have to say? What would be the takeaway? And to encourage a dialogue. I'm not into a talking head program here tonight. I'm not going to hopefully put you to sleep with stuff that you really don't care about. So with your permission, let me just go around the room, if I could, and ask folks, what is it what's your objective? What is it that you'd like to walk out of here with tonight? And I'll try as best I can to make sure that in my comments and in the interactions we have that I'm covering the ground that you would like me to cover.
Everybody
else? Well, I mean, we can have a conversation, but yeah, let's just kind of, I'm trying to get a feel for what it is that people would like to get from this experience.
I focus about risks, as well as risk intelligence, the topics that you run into, how people manage those risks. There's so many different risks going on in the world today from a Black Swan perspective, and certainly within the corporations themselves, and what type of structures they're using to do that, and what are the dilemmas in installing the decision making.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Any current board issues that you're exposed to that you might think are interesting?
Okay. That's good.
I've had a couple of board crises in the past. I'm not sure I handle them as well as I might have, but I want to know how to be better prepared.
Okay.
How's that for a second?
That's a perfect, it's like
teed it up.
Right on the
second banana in another life.
Call me Ed McMahon.
Okay. Exactly. I'm no Johnny Cusson, I'll tell you that. I'll admit, no Johnny. Yes.
I'm here to learn as much as I can from the group. So
okay.
Well, based on the topic, I would really get a feel from other folks how much time, effort the boards actually need, not do, but need, when it comes to really low frequency kinds of issues, black swan kinds of issues.
Mm-hmm. Dick?
I think some of the other people I interested in how boards think about risk, especially out of industries outside of what I'm familiar with, how they deal with their risk, anticipate it, and solve it.
Mm-hmm. Mike?
My issue is, in terms of how aggressive should the board be in terms of pushing it in administration or in terms of future strategy and planning for the future?
one or two of them get politically sensitive sometimes, like one of them is all with refugees, and the mayor of Manchester is in that way, so he gets one of the refugees in Manchester, New Hampshire.
Yes.
So how do you deal with some of those issues? What's the obligation? What's the level of risk that you're self carrying when you get involved with some of these issues?
Effective communications, how do you create transparency, board performance, or lack thereof, how do you measure it, etc.
Uh-huh.
In public company, how much is taken into account when there is a crisis? At the board level, how much of the public ownership and stock price reaction is taken into account in the discussion of a strategy? So, for instance, when Steve Jobs was known to be very gravely ill, there was a lot of controversy about the ethics of keeping that from shareholders versus making it public. And I'm very interested in the tension that that was created at the board level and how they evolved on that level.
Actually, I did a blog on that because Jobs elected to be very... had an amazing lack of transparency on that issue. They hid it. And it was a material event. I'm not a lawyer, but I've had enough experience in dealing with these matters to talk a little bit about it. And the lack of transparency and the fact that that was not fully disclosed, because I would view that as a material event, that's been an issue that has been talked about at some length and reported on at some length. But I frankly don't believe that Apple and its board did what they should have done on that matter as it relates to, you got a CEO who's essentially dying and they're not fully disclosing what's going on with this person. And he is...
CEO.
I'm sorry?
It's not exactly ordinary CEO.
That is true. That is true. Yes, go ahead.
I think now with social media and the transparency that's out there and the fact that there's a 24-hour news cycle, boards are really more exposed. I think it's important for them to understand why
our focused public attention on where are they.
Mm-hmm.
Yes?
I guess I'd like to get your thoughts on the recent issue in Libya. Does your expertise is in the area of strategic communication and crisis management.
Uh-huh.
So we're now learning, you know, the public here in the U.S. is learning that, you know, this wasn't just a demonstration, it was more of a terror attack. Apparently we knew about it 24 hours after it happened. Probably most people in this room thought it was when it happened. But, you know, how would you advise the Obama administration to handle that interesting situation? Because it's kind of evolved over a two-week period to now where everybody finally says it's a terrorist attack. If that's not a crisis, I don't know what is.
Yes, Neil.
I'm always interested in finding the balance between operating the company, whatever that means, at a strategic level, I'm talking about the board, but operating the company, keeping risk in mind, but also in a board environment where to overstate it, you know, you're in for a quarterly meeting and some updates every once in a while. And Mindy says, where's the board's role when Twitter goes viral in about 5 minutes? How do you fit into that? That's a big paradox here.
Mm-hmm. It sure is.
Just from my perspective, the level of transparency on a specific crisis and how transparency occurs throughout the organization and the impact to the culture of the organization. Because if there's a crisis, it can trigger down the organization and change the significant culture.
Mm-hmm.
So, just want to get your thoughts on that.
Okay. Yes.
So it triggers down one of the... So, Jim's obviously had a lot of interesting times in the last few years. Is the aspect of almost too much transparency?
Mm-hmm.
It may not be responsible to communicate certain things because the consequences aren't understood by shareholders and others.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the question, what liability do you have in that area? In other words,
role if I put something out that says da 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 da. Maybe true or not true. Mm-hmm. The consequences may not be well understood. It couldn't be understood.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're not clear at the time that you're disclosing.
Mm-hmm.
So, what about those kind of changes?
How many people are familiar with the Globe series that was written by Brian McGrory about Liberty Mutual? Is everybody in this room has some knowledge of that issue? Maybe you didn't. But basically, Liberty Mutual, mutually owned company, CEO comes on board in, what was it, the late 90s, I guess? 92, 93, succeeds Gary Countryman as a CEO. The company is okay, but not in great shape. They put together a compensation package for the CEO, which if he meets or exceeds certain objectives that are agreed upon at that point in time, he has an opportunity to realize a tremendous upside. The net effect was in the last 4 years of his tenure as CEO of this company, he made $50 million. Yeah. 50,000 would be a rounding error. $50 million a year, with a total compensation package well in excess of $200 million over a 4 year period. And of course, the media, there's a reporter at the Globe or a columnist at the Globe named Brian McGrory. Liberty Mutual, I think, to the point that one of you folks made, just wasn't prepared to manage this issue. They were not particularly transparent. And sometimes when you have a really good reporter dealing with an issue and he can access or she can access publicly available information, there's no place to run or hide, because even in a mutually owned company, it's not as transparent as a publicly traded company, but they're still, you know, they have filings and periodic things with the insurance commissioner of every state, and so on and so forth. So you can actually get at this information. And, you know, the number of questions surface as a result of this. You know, where was the board on that issue? What was their level of responsibility in all this? How did they respond to it? How did the operating side of the business, the people, the management team respond to it? And why did, in my entire career, I have never seen more columns written about one company over such a short period of time as what happened to Liberty Mutual. Because at every turn, McGrory, and they were doing the stiff arm program, they were not being transparent, even though they knew at some point he'd get at it, because he's a good reporter. I know him. I've worked with him. And I think it was a case of them thinking if they, and I call this the head in the sand strategy, you know, you say, well, you know, the tidal wave is coming, but if I turn my back to it and I don't really deal with it, maybe it'll not hit the shore, but you know it's going to hit the shore, and you just ignore it. And what happens is that when that kind of event happens, particularly with a good reporter, or a good news media outlet, whether it be the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, that is like putting red meat in front of a dog. And when that kind of thing happens, companies, the natural tendency is to pull in the horns and jump into the bunker and you know, close the ranks. And actually, I wrote a blog about this. And instead of saying, look, you know, we need to put this into the proper context. This man came in, assumed a position. Not only did he meet our expectations, he exceeded them by a wide margin. With the benefit of hindsight, would the package have been that rich? Probably not. But he earned it. He did it the old-fashioned way. He earned it. He turned this company in a different direction, increased equity by a multiple of 5 times. I mean, so there were some talking points they could have used as a pushback. They chose not to do that. And because they chose not to do that, and because the board, you know, because I'm on the outside looking in, but the optics of it, you know, where's the board? And because the board was not speaking on this issue, one of the columns was focused right on the board and how much they made and the kinds of, you know, benefits they had as a board member. So then now you've got board involvement. And then you say, well, what about your employees? You know, you're cutting heads. You're reducing your SG&A. And your senior executives are flying jets from Hanscom Air Force Base to Cape Cod. I mean, you know, you don't need a Lear 60 or a Global, you know, to kind of get from Lexington to Hyannis. I mean, that's a little bit of a... And all that information was readily accessible. So if you do something that you shouldn't do or you shouldn't be doing from a governance perspective, step up and take responsibility. You know, a number of years ago, we were retained by the Society of Jesus. And for those of you aren't of the Catholic persuasion or faith, that's the Jesuit priests. And we were asked to try to help them on this abuse issue with children. And I interviewed the priest who was the head Jesuit for this region and said to him, are you willing to... The first question was, do you think Cardinal Law did a good job managing the situation? The answer was no. Do you think that... Are you willing to listen to advice? The answer was yes. And I'm saying, boy, this is going in the right direction, okay? And then I said, okay, you don't have to buy what I sell, but you have to just give it a fair hearing because you may not agree with my recommendation, and you're going to have to live with this for now and hereafter. And so we outlined a strategy for them where we said, look, step up here. Take responsibility for what's happened. Cooperate fully with the authorities that are looking into these issues. Reach out to the victims and their families. Create a helpline for those who don't want to come forward publicly but want to talk about it. And set your agenda. How do you manage it? Because you can't control the media's agenda. You can't control others' agendas. Plaintiff's lawyers, you can't control their agendas for sure. But you can control what you do. And how you respond to this will not be forgotten and will be remembered by those that it's affected and haven't been affected as a result of it. And to their credit, they followed that advice. And they were, although they were part of the story because it was the Roman Catholic Church, they were in and out of that story in 2 days and were never mentioned again because they identified the priests that were the perpetrators of these issues with the children. They cooperated with the DA. They did everything that they should have done as a responsible organization should do. And it was interesting because a friend of mine who happens to be a plaintiff's lawyer and I were having lunch at the Four Seasons subsequent to all this happening, 6 months later, and he was regaling me with the details that he represents 27 victims of this abuse and how the plaintiff's bar was talking about how Cardinal Lahr handled it versus the Jesuits. And the people on the plaintiff's bar said, you know, Cardinal Lahr had handled it like the Jesuits did. He didn't know I was working with the Jesuits, of course. I told him later. This probably wouldn't have been the kind of issue that it could have morphed into and created a pathway for people to redress their grievances in a far less public way. So there are issues that you have to, you know, kind of deal with the fact set. Oftentimes in a situation, in a crisis, there's an information void. People don't have the facts. And the worst thing you can do in a crisis, like Mitt Romney recently did when this ambassador was killed in Libya, was he politicized the death of a public official who represented our country in a foreign country. And he didn't understand the dynamics of the American spirit in that you don't attack a sitting president when someone who's in service to our country is killed. You rally around the president. American people rally around the president. Whether you like his politics or not, it's still an American president and it represents the institution in our country. So there are times when you really have to sort of take charge, take responsibility. And to get back to your question about, you know, what I've advised the Obama administration to do, and I, you know, you immediately think about, it's almost like what we're talking about here tonight and what I think is it Mindy had indicated. People don't want to prepare for the black swan event. They want to, not going to happen here. What do you mean? I run a good company. We've done nothing wrong. What do you? And I talk about this when I give presentations on crisis management. I say, you know, when we were kids in the playground, somebody took a shot at us. What was our natural inclination, right? You swing back. Don't swing back. Do not swing back. Step back. Compose yourself. Take control of the situation to the extent that you can. And so with regard to Obama, ounce of prevention, 30 pounds of cure. When you have a representative of the U.S. government in a country that might be considered borderline hostile, the first thing you would do, it would seem to me, logic would suggest that you would beef up security of those people. And that, to me, reflected a lack of responsiveness on the part of the White House and the State Department and the Defense Department and the CIA. I mean, there's plenty of blame to go around here. And had they done things they should have done, had they planned for that event, particularly in today's world, I mean, you can't plan for a 9/11. We all understand that. But there are risks that you can plan for, and that's to your point. There are risks that are out there. Things happen. But when they happen, people have a natural inclination to get defensive, put the fist up, and dive into the bunker. And that's the worst thing you can do. Yes?
Came to mind for me was, what methodology, or is there a methodology, that you can apply to manage misinterpretation?
Well, that's a very good question, and I'll tell you why. Most often in a crisis, and you'll see this a lot, I'm sure we've all seen 60 Minutes, and we've dealt with 60 Minutes a number of times. And what happens is that the way 60 Minutes sources a story is they call it second source reporting. The Boston Globe writes a story about the priest abuse issue. 60 Minutes has readers in New York scanning papers all over the country all the time and globally all the time to get ideas, story ideas. What makes this relevant to at least 30 million Americans going to watch this program tonight? But so what and who cares? So they get in touch with a reporter at the Globe, and they, you know, this is 60 Minutes, and they come up and they interview the reporter from the Globe, and they say, okay, what else that you would, if you had more time or you weren't on deadline, what are there any other dimensions to this story that might be different or new or things that you didn't have the opportunity to explore in your reporting? And inevitably the reporter will come up with something. That then, they take the, so that's second source reporting. They go to the reporter who did it, then they come up with their own thinking around from an editorial, a news perspective, and the producers begin to think through what the storyline is going to be, how they're going to articulate the story, how they're going to deal with the story. So that process is something that a lot of news organizations use, particularly broadcast, and they always want people on camera. And I can't recall the incident, but it was a used car dealer in Texas, and Steve Croft had him right by the short hair, and you know, they have him at the conference room table, and the fellow's leaning in like this, and he doesn't know who Steve Cross is, but he's agreed to a bright, you know, a television interview. He's a little slow on the uptake, I think. He's bragging about how he's playing with the odometers on cars and how he's reset. Did you see that piece? Remember that piece? So he's there, and he's bragging about it, and then all of a sudden, Croft reveals himself. By the way, I'm Steve Croft from 60 Minutes. All of a sudden, we do media training. We talk about there's two kinds of communications, verbal and nonverbal. The guy goes from this to this. Like this. He didn't have to say a word. He said everything he had to say. That was what I call the knockout punch. But So what we do in crisis work typically is we'll tell clients to, we issue statements, written statements, so they stay on message. We do not put them on camera, typically. Now, there are some circumstances where you might, but in most cases, we recommend that clients do not go on camera, that they go with a written statement that's no more than two or three sentences, that is very cogent, direct, and responsive to the issue at hand. When we develop crisis plans, we put together Q&As. We sit down and we say, what's the 800-pound gorilla in the room here? How are we going to respond to this kind of a question? And then we figure out how you can respond to the question without being totally transparent, because sometimes it's not appropriate because of the timing issue, because there's litigation pending. So there's only so far you can go when you're crafting a response. And you're not trying to be obsequious or duck or run and hide, but what you're trying to do is be responsive to the issue at hand in a thoughtful way. Now, I don't know how many of you are following this matter up in Exeter, New Hampshire, with this serial infector, they call him, the fellow with the hepatitis C, you know. NBC News is on that story. They'll be reporting on it, 30 Rock, or is it with Brian Williams, it's on Thursday night. And they're doing some reporting on that now. And Exeter Hospital, for a long time, was not being particularly responsive to the whole thing. They were kind of in complete disarray. I noticed recently they're beginning now to push back a little bit. But there are issues that go around, and a lot of it's judgment calls. The other thing that we do is we always make sure that before we do anything, and typically the way it works in our business and crisis work is that the law firm representing the client will retain us. And there's a reason for that. And the reason is to try to protect the privilege. Doesn't mean it's impenetrable, but if the law firm retains us to do the work, that in our work product becomes part of, quote, mounting a proper defense. Judge Kaplan in the Second District in New York ruled that if a PR firm did not have a prior relationship with a client organization, with a company, and the company was retained, the PR firm was retained by a law firm to represent the county company in mounting a proper defense, that then is considered privileged information. So any communications that we have with lawyers or with clients is considered privileged. Now, as I said, it's not impenetrable, and I think, Mindy, you'd agree with that if you've done any work in that space. But so from a process standpoint, that's what we do. But the risk, measuring the risk associated with it, it's vetted through legal counsel, inside and out. It's vetted through the client organization so that whatever is issued in a public forum, whether it be in a letter to employees or to communications to Wall Street, that all of that's cleared well in advance. And that's the process that we follow very closely for obvious reasons, I would hope. Yes?
The discussion has been really on the aftermath, the step after. Something happens, crisis of some type. And I think at that stage, it really comes down to one thing, it's about leadership.
Correct.
And at that stage, if you don't have the right leaders in the room, it's too late.
Correct.
So, you know, part of it is making sure the board's responsibility of having the right people in the board, having the right leadership in the company, the folks that do the process of looking at what the risks are, to try to, you know, to establish that. And then how do you react? And it does come down to communication and honesty, I think, absolute transparency. And you tell your folks, because it's not just external, it's internal.
That's right.
And when the dot-com crashed, we were in ancillary industry, and my business was $3 billion. We had an 18-month backlog. When the dot-coms crashed, we had $1 billion in orders canceled in 6 weeks. We went from 18 months to 18 seconds.
Wow.
And we had 14,000 people, and I assess we're going to have to go to 8,000 in the course of a month if you figure this out. And how do you communicate that? And that's just about being open and honest. But that's after the fact.
Right.
You know, nobody saw it coming.
Right.
In, you know, in our business.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think the communication part is the most critical, being open and honest and having people know that. And in fact, telling them, you know, there may be certain things we can't say for legal reasons.
Correct.
And we're telling you up front that we can't.
And but you know, you're right, because people respond to that. If you're open and honest with people, they can tell. People are a lot smarter than we think they are. If you try to blow smoke, they'll eat your lunch.
Yeah.
And they won't believe you. But the predicate to that happening is how the table is set every day.
Yep.
The ongoing communications with your key constituencies, whether they be internal or external, doesn't matter. If you build a reservoir of goodwill and trust in your communications and you're open and direct with people about where you are and what's going on, then that will serve you well, particularly in a crisis, because people will say, well, you know, they've always given it to us straight. And anyone can understand a downturn in business. It happens. That doesn't, you know, it's not always a hockey stick in life. Sometimes the hockey stick goes the other way, which is what happened to you.
The other angle here is that a lot of these inputs we've been speaking about are they really black swan events, or should they have been anticipated and prevented?
Well, that's the risk assessment issue. And part of the problem is there aren't many companies that want to address risk. And I don't know how you folks view this, but there's an unwillingness, you know, this what I call the syndrome, it can't happen here. But any board member, in my view, that isn't sitting down and talking with management about the policies, the procedures, the governance issues, compensation issues, what I would consider the hot button issues, they're not doing their job. People need to be in that loop, and they need to assess risk.
A board's responsibility, and the manager, actually, aside from the manager team, is to evaluate risk and mitigate risk before it turns into a black swan.
Well, that's part of the... Right.
Telling situation, they were paying them $50 million well before the news story broke.
That's correct.
And it didn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that a mutual insurance company paying this guy big paychecks.
Right.
You know, this public information, you know, suppose somebody, you know, might have sensitivity. They could have been well prepared for, they may have felt that it was well deserved and he earned it, but they should have been prepared that this may, I guess, the light of day.
They should have identified, you're absolutely right, they should have identified that risk, because that was a risk to their reputation.
And then they should have been sensitive to their credibility, because they didn't have to fly people down from Anscombe to Cape Cod. I mean, they should have stopped that practice long before.
Yeah.
I mean, the guy earned $50 million. He earned these stock offers, that's one thing. Nothing is to abuse the company's expenses by taking advantage of that.
But, I mean, as I followed it, and having sort of dealt with Liberty Mutual,
yes,
they were a very arrogant company, always were.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So it's one thing for us to say they should have, they did say that. Everybody sitting around the table probably thought they were doing the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, we're Monday morning quarterbacking it.
Sure.
I think the black swan shows up when, well, that's why it's called the black swan, when it's something that you just totally didn't expect.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you're asking these guys to around the board at Liberty to have done something which I think was contrary to the way.
I mean, you're right. The seeds are also some type of culture.
Yeah. They thought they were doing the perfectly right thing. It would never be. It would never come up. So here's really what we're talking about. Wow.
Yeah.
Not only. What do you mean you're questioning these guys?
It's the board's responsibility to push management to look at the risks that can be pre-thought.
And they had a board. They had selected a board that thought they were doing everything fine.
Sure, but let me take that and let me make an observation and ask for everybody's opinion. There's two core responsibilities of the board. There's advice and counsel to the CEO, and there's audit and oversight. And everybody will say it should be 50-50. And it never is. It's always sort of, it's always skewed in one way, or it's skewed in the other way. And what I find is there are CEO board dynamics. So, for example, I'm on a board where the CEO is calling me like twice twice a week these days to let me know what's going on before it goes on. And he's really using his board, not just me, as his advice and counsel. But that's easy because it's a founder-dominated board. Now, what I've seen on the other side is in the private equity situation, where the CEO gets into this mentality, it's really audit and oversight. And so if I bring anything to the board, I really got to say, there was a problem, I fixed it. Mission accomplished. But that CEO would not bring the problem to the board at the earliest stage and says, I need your advice about what to do, for fear that the board would say, well, aren't we paying you to figure this out? And how do you create the right, and this is a question for everybody, and that's on a board of directors, how do you create the right dynamics between the board and the CEO so that the CEO knows at what point to begin to talk to the board about an emerging issue? Because I think a lot of CEOs' instincts are, I'm the world's number one problem solver, so I should be able to figure out the problem and solve it, and then bring the mission accomplished to the board. And that's, any experiences here?
I'll go first. My advice to the CEO, start with the small problems and establish a pattern with the board of, I just wanted to let you know this is going on and I'm dealing with it. And if it's small enough, the board's not going to be worried about it, and you will identify the problem or at least solve the problem. If you come back with a bigger problem, you've got the, okay, come to us early, and then you solve the problem.
So it's a training.
So sort of that, train them.
CEO
train
the board.
Train the mindset.
I think it's also the board, though, has to establish with the CEO and the CFO and the rest of the C-suite that you know, what's expected. And a simple rule is bad news is okay, surprises aren't. And help to define what that means so that when do you have to tell us soon enough that it's not a surprise.
And how many of you have ever been on boards where that's explicit?
Given my background, prior to my current role, I was with Bank of America in corporate audit, and our dotted line reported to the board of directors and not to the CEO. And I thought that was extremely important because I'm hearing the word risk, there's different types of risk within our organization, operational, financial, technology, et cetera. And what ends up happening is, even a large organization, a small organization, they're trying to run a business. And the trick is, what's palatable for risk? What's the exception? How much risk can we take and continue doing the business? At the end of the day, what ends up happening is, an audit or another risk manager will find something. And it's not the little things that fight them, it's the bigger thing. And it's bigger than the organization. I think you were saying, you know, you gotta do something in a month. Well, within a month, you're not gonna be able to solve this problem. You're gonna need a lot more time. And it really comes down to how strong is that bench within your audit team or your risk. And what ends up happening is you're focusing on sales and revenue, and risk I've seen is always not getting that support.
We just say that reported to the chairman of the board.
Yeah. That's how we did it.
The explicit rules of engagement. It's explicit. I don't see it happen explicitly that much. And both, am I going to reduce the strength of our relationship? And it's all about that relationship and your confidence in me, if you will, as a CEO and you as the board. Or not, how do we measure that, how do we manage that? And how a question that came to me in this discussion is, this is intangible. This is all, hey, do I have your value system? Do we have that same value system? Are you pushing your perspective on us, per se?
Mm-hmm.
How do we make that tangible? How do we make that measurable so we make it less intangible? And first, we're just, you're not allowed to speak in the room, we're going to finally move your way and move in that direction. How do you make it tangible?
So when you
are
look
you
at your... When you
think make it visible, make it tangible.
Part of what we're talking about is transparency in the boardroom. I mean,
yeah.
If you don't have it there, you don't have a whole house.
I think you have to distinguish between, in the relationship CEO to the board, the difference between reporting to the board, right, telling the board, and having conversations with directors.
Mm-hmm.
Those are two different. If we're talking about these are the rules, right, these are things that can't be measured. There's little problems, little leaks that, you know, if you say, geez, it's time. time to tell the board. Once you tell the board, you've said, this is important, right? I'm telling the board. It's another thing to have a conversation with the director over dinner. Because I got this little thing I'm looking at. I don't think it's anything.
Well, I praise you for that for having a fence day.
But yeah, I know it well.
But in your business, you know, what are the metrics that you use on your risk analysis? How do you, what do you look at?
It depends on the problem set. So you define the problem first, and then you determine internal and external factors that you define correlate together to see these patterns, which will drive your thinking to new correlations that you need to make to go further and deeper in those patterns.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but now, if I have a visual pattern, which we can present, if you will, and I'll discuss that right now, and I can at least show you the risk. I've been trying to tell you 6 months about this risk, and I can at least show you the risk. It may be about people, it may be about competitors, business, whatever it is. Let's make it visible, make it, and that's as close to the end of what we can get, to move it out of, it's in my head, I think I'm seeing the same thing you're seeing. You know, how do we talk about this intelligently aside from just having people trying to push their value system around?
Well, the most effective way I've seen it dealt with is you have to have a process that's rigorous, looking at risk and the dimensions that affect risk of a particular organization.
Mm-hmm.
Have a process where you actually investigate those areas of risk and have good feedback in terms of evaluating where the company stands on those risk areas. But have the process to be, you know, open, rigorous, get below the board level so management is responding to those questions, and then talk to the board fairly frequently. And that totally helps the situation versus doing it as a, you know, as an aside or only when something is percolating, do you actually talk about risk. You have to, you know, you have to, the process where you talk about risk well before.
Well, when we put together crisis contingency plans, which this is on, this is before the event occurs. It's like, okay, let's take a look. I'll sit down with the CEO and I say to either he or she, what are the three things that keep you up at night? What are your biggest concerns? What is the thing that is most concerning to you as a CEO? What is the potential black swan event that could occur? Not likely, but it could occur. And if you can get them to identify three areas, and then you can, and or what are your organizational vulnerabilities? Where are you vulnerable? Go ahead.
I wouldn't limit that discussion to the CEO, though. I would make a broad base to the CEO.
No, that's a CEO conversation. Yes.
What you're describing to me, and the way I've rephrased that, is stress testing scenarios.
Mm-hmm.
So you say scenario 1, 2, and lay them all on the table based on our current knowledge today. Tomorrow that may be new current knowledge.
Right.
How do we stress test
that
in all different ways, all different dimensions? And I agree with the structure and process approach that you have to have a rigorous structure and process. Without static measures, not that you're implying that, without static measures, because they're always going to be changing across many dimensions.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting because I recall a number of years ago, I went to New York to meet with a person who was the CEO of a major chemical company that will remain anonymous for soon to be obvious reasons. And they had two manufacturing plants that produced a gas that, if there was a leak, was Bhopal all over again. And I said to him, what would you do if this happened at one of your manufacturing facilities where you manufacture this lethal gas? His response was, can't happen. Can't happen. Really? Why can't it not happen? Well, because we have backup systems. Really? Did you ever hear 3 Mile Island? They had backup systems. They failed. They weren't sufficient. And he just shut me down. I mean, he brought me to New York to talk to him about risk management and